Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest indictment in the Mueller investigation, announced on Friday by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, which accuses 13 Russians and three Russian entities of intervening in the 2016 election to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton. James Risen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning former investigative reporter with the New York Times, who is now the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept, where he has an article, "Is Donald Trump a Traitor?" joins us. We'll discuss what could be the most consequential covert operation since Germany put Lenin on a train to Petrograd in 1917, and how much Russia's new czar, the former KGB Colonel Vladimir Putin, has created a state run by a consortium of spies, gangsters, and oligarchs in which Putin regulates the oligarchs, handing out state assets and government contracts in exchange for political favors and off-the-books covert operations and influence campaigns, which are augmented by legions of trolls and self-financed internet criminals. Then we'll look into the possibility that something might actually be done in response to the latest mass shooting beyond the usual sop of thoughts and prayers, this time led by the young survivors at the Florida High School, who held an impassioned rally over the weekend calling out President Trump and lawmakers on the NRA payroll with chants of "shame on you" and "vote them out." An expert on the Second Amendment, Saul Cornell, the chair of history at Fordham University, whose latest book is "The Second Amendment Goes to Court," joins us to discuss the planned march by the students on Washington on March the 24th and how the Second Amendment has been misinterpreted to give unlimited rights to a small minority of gun fanatics at the expense of the rights of Americans to have, as the Founding Fathers intended, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Then finally, we will speak with Ganesh Shataraman, a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School and a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is the author of a new book just out, "The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution: Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic." We'll discuss how the United States was uniquely set up as an egalitarian democracy in opposition to the feudal rule of the British aristocracy, and that if rising income inequality is not addressed, it will destroy the American Constitution. And joining us now is James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of the New York Times bestseller State of War, among other books. In 2006, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is "Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War." And he has an article at The Intercept, "Is Donald Trump a Traitor?" Welcome to Background Briefing, James Risen.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, James. And short of answering your question, is Donald Trump a traitor? What we learned from the Mueller indictment is that the Russians were actively involved in helping elect him and hurting Hillary Clinton. The National Security Advisor, speaking at a security conference in Munich, said that the proof was incontrovertible that the Russians meddled in our election, and Donald Trump has already castigated General McMaster. So it's a bit odd, isn't it, to have a president of the United States who is not responding to this indictment from his own Justice Department in terms of a foreign adversary attacking the United States. Instead, he's turned it all about himself and claiming vindication. An historical analogy perhaps would be if after Pearl Harbor, FDR invited Emperor Hirohito over to the White House for a sushi dinner.
Well, I think Trump knows that, and the reason he's doing it is because this points the finger at him and his campaign, and he knows that's where this is all headed. He is afraid that he is going to be charged, or that people close to him will be charged with enabling or colluding with this what Mueller described as a coordinated effort by Russia to damage Clinton and elect Trump. And so he, I think, understands the consequences for him of this. And so he is insistent on continuing to lie and mislead the attempt to mislead the public about the Mueller investigation, and he's attempting to discredit it.
But and a normal person, let alone a president of the United States, would be embarrassed by these revelations. He wouldn't want, surely, the American people in the world to feel that his election was illegitimate and that the Russians put him in there. You would think he'd be the first to want to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah, it makes you wonder whether there's something to it. That's, to me, the all of the evidence of his efforts to discredit Mueller and the congressional investigations into Russian meddling and the efforts that suggest obstruction of justice by Trump of firing Comey and pressuring Sessions and putting pressure on the intelligence community. It all suggests that there's a man who has something to hide. And I think that's, the common sense look at his behavior suggests that he is hiding there's something he may know about what happened. And I think that's the next big shoe to drop in this investigation. We now have a very strong evidence that the Russians were behind the meddling in the election. And now the next question to be answered more conclusively than it has been so far is, what was the Trump campaign colluding with Russia?
So in terms of the premise that in the introduction that this former KGB colonel Vladimir Putin has created a state-run run by a consortium of spies, gangsters, and oligarchs in which Putin regulates the oligarchs, handing out state assets and government contracts in exchange for political favors and off-the-books covert operations and influence campaigns, which are augmented by legions of trolls and self-financed criminals. That's my conclusion, that we actually have a total state effectively built in and around the image of a kind of wannabe KGB spy. The most talented KGB officers were assigned to NATO capitals and New York and Washington. He was languishing in East Germany through a series of extraordinary events under a addled Yeltsin. He became the head of the KGB and then the prime minister and then the president of Russia. But it seems to that he's brought with him this kind of KGB mindset of glavny vrag or glavny protivnik, the main enemy, the main adversary. And he doesn't do anything for Russia except loot it. But his entire focus seems to be on the U.S. And he's built a state around himself. This is a kind of extraordinary hybrid of gangsters, oligarchs, and spies, or Siloviki, as they call them.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's why Trump fits so well into that narrative. In my opinion, I think he is, I don't think he ever seriously thought about becoming president, and it was all just some kind of weird game for him and a branding effort at first. But once it became a serious enterprise, I think he's probably willing to do almost anything. And so that's the next question. Did he or people around him collude and cooperate with what we now know was an organized effort by the Putin regime to tip the scales of the election in favor of Trump? And I don't think it is very hard to explain or understand why he would have wanted Trump instead of Hillary Clinton. Trump is kind of a fool, and you could easily see him being a dupe. He's a shameless narcissist who just wants attention and, doesn't really understand the world. So I think if you're Putin, the motivation for supporting Trump is clear. You want chaos and paralysis in the United States, and that's good for Putin.
Well, you're almost describing him as Polezhny Durak, the Russian word for a useful idiot. And obviously, yeah. In this context, Jill Stein is a useful idiot. So is Oliver Stone. A lot of Americans have bought in to the narrative, which forever, whatever reasons, even the editors of The Nation, it mystifies me why people on the left see somehow Putin as a socialist or something. I mean, he's a right-wing religious fascist.
I think it's an interesting phenomenon where I think they are, I think there's a long history in the United States and the left in the United States of despairing of liberals and more moderate progressives, and that they want, they want to shake up the system. And so their focus and their perspective is usually from domestic political viewpoint. And so they sometimes overlook the flaws of the more distant people who they somehow think might be doing what they want.
And again, I'm speaking with James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and the author of The New York Times.
That happened on the left with Stalin, too,
Well, it's true. I mean, there were people here in Los Angeles after the Hitler-Stalin Pact demonstrating in front of the Lockheed Aircraft Company out here in Burbank because Lockheed was selling bombers to the British.
Right.
I mean, talk about useful idiots. But in any case, I was going to just reintroduce you in terms of your latest book, Pay Any Price,
sure.
Greed, Power, and Endless War, and your article at The Intercept, Is Donald Trump a Traitor? Going through the indictment, obviously it was 37 pages. It was extremely thorough. It indicates that the U.S. Mueller has access to all of the top intelligence, because it's clear that the U.S. were watching these people in St. Petersburg at the so-called IRA. But this character, Prigozhin, who's known as Putin's cook, he seems to be a sort of an example of that, what I was mentioning in the opening of first of all, Putin sprang him from jail. He was jailed by the Soviets for robbery and prostitution. But Putin sprung him very early on, and he's turned him into a billionaire. He gets government contracts to supply all the food to the schools in Russia. But in exchange for a few billions state contracts, he kicks back a few million to fund these off-the-book operations. And that's a perfect piece of spycraft, isn't it, where you don't have your fingerprints going back even to your own intelligence services?
Yeah, well, I think, in the United States, we have contractors who do work for the intelligence community and the defense community, and it's not exactly the same thing, but there's some similarities where you have someone like Eric Prince in Blackwater that does work for the CIA, and so I think, granted, the way that the Soviets or the Russians do it is very different, but it doesn't just because this company in St. Petersburg is not nominally part of the Russian intelligence doesn't mean that this wasn't a Russian intelligence operation.
Well, it looks like the people that they sent over here were intelligence officers.
Right.
And
so I think, it's essentially a contractor.
Right.
To Russian intelligence.
But I would think the main difference is that the contractors here in the United States, which is really an example of what my friend Bob Baer calls Nigeria on the Potomac, the contractors
right.
have caused nothing but trouble. It was, after all, yeah. the contractors who failed to properly screen Edward Snowden after he had been caught by the CIA back in 1998, breaking into the CIA's crown jewels, and the contractors that somehow failed again with this huge loss of NSA data which the so-called shadow brokers got hold of, which has essentially weaponized China and Russia against the United States. They haven't pulled the trigger, but our contractors have been, and of course the OPM hack was, people responsible for that were a government contractor who didn't secure the data on all of these government employees. So that would be a fundamental difference, isn't it? The Russians seem
No, it's not the same thing, but it's a very, to me, the fact that this is listed as a private company in St. Petersburg doesn't mean that this wasn't a Russian intelligence operation. And I think one of the interesting things to me is how, you know, in this case, Mueller focuses his efforts on the Facebook bots and the fake news. And we've yet to see him issue indictments directly on the hack of the DNC.
Right. There are many strands to this because it was an intelligence operation with many strands. And you know, just one strand, if it's as it appears to be that Jill Stein and the Green Party were useful idiots, then the votes that she got in those three key swing states were greater than Hillary's loss. So it's difficult.
Yeah, I think, as you said, there's a lot of different threads to this. And I've been impressed that Mueller seems to be kind of moving very deliberately through each strand. You know, it was difficult to kind of see at first with the Manafort indictment and some of the other indictments exactly what direction he was going to be taking. But with this latest set of indictments, you know, things are beginning to come into focus, I think, a little bit more.
I thought it was clever also, Rod Rosenstein, to let Trump off the hook in this case so he doesn't give him any provocation to fire him, because clearly Trump is going crazy with this situation. Apparently he rails around the White House all the time about this Russia investigation because it's, as I think the title of your article suggests, is Donald Trump a traitor? He may well be a traitor.
I think that's the next, you know, one of the next, the final steps of this thing is that, you know, where, you know, Mueller is looking. It strikes me that the state of play of what we now know is we now know pretty conclusively that Russia meddled in the election. We also know that Trump and people around him, that there is a lot of evidence that Trump and people around him have sought to obstruct Mueller's investigation or the investigations in Congress. And so the area that we still need more information on is why is Trump so interested in shutting down Mueller's investigation? And that raises a question that perhaps it's because of collusion. And he's afraid of what Mueller is going to find. And so that's the middle part that we still have to focus on. And I think it's almost as if Mueller is going to come at that from both directions, both from the Russian side and from the side of the obstruction cases and the conspiracy cases that he's building against Manafort and some of the other people.
Well, just in closing, there's an assumption, though, that Putin has some kind of blackmail over Trump because his behavior is so crazy and strange and counterintuitive in terms of an innocent man, which he appears not to be. So is that, at the end of the day, what it could be, could explain it, blackmail?
I think that's one of several possibilities. It's either that or it could be that there's something besides collusion that Trump is afraid that Mueller is going to find out. Mm-hmm. You know, something about his finances or his personal life, or it could just be that there were too many people in the Trump campaign who knew about the Russian meddling, and they were in contact with the Russians,
right.
And that, you know, that you could build a mosaic of a conspiracy.
Right.
And that's a real interesting question.
Sure, and it may well go back a longer way. I mean, what explains why he went after Obama with this canard about not having a birth certificate. That seems to be the same purpose that Putin signed him with, which is to divide America. Czech intelligence goes back to 77 with files on the family, the wife of the kids, the mother, who he pretty much deserted. They were spent all of their summers in behind the Iron Curtain. So there are ties to this family that are quite deep and long. So we can only wait. And I thank you for joining us, James Risen.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Risen, who's the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of the New York Times bestseller State of War. In 2006, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Is Donald Trump a Traitor? We can take a brief station break and back looking into whether something will actually be done following this latest gun massacre led by the young students who held a rally over the weekend from the Florida High School and planned to march on Washington on March the 24th. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Saul Cornell, who's the chair in American history at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. And his forthcoming book is The Partisan Republic, Democracy Exclusion, and the Demise of the Founders' Constitution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Saul Cornell.
Thank you for having me.
And Saul, I must say these young students from the Florida High School that suffered such a horrible tragedy last week with so many of their classmates murdered before their eyes. One of the young students in particular has been, Emma Gonzalez, has been featured on television in an impassioned speech at a rally that they held going after the NRA specifically. She said, to every politician who is taking donations from the NRA, shame on you. The crowd began to chant, Vote them out. So they're going to be holding a rally, a students' march in Washington, I believe, on March the 24th. So is this something that we could, because every after these shootings, nothing ever gets done. The whole thing becomes so sad and so pathetic that, you know, it's like a broken record. And you and I have conversations every year or so, or every 6 months or so, depending on how many people were massacred. Do you think this is going to be different this time because of the energy and the intelligence and the passion of these young people?
Well, I do think that we're seeing something quite remarkable with these young people because they have managed to take control of the discussion and shift it in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. So I'm very, very optimistic, much more optimistic than I've been in a very long time. It's also happening at a good time. You know, it's a time where other reform movements and calls for change, you know, the attention to sexual harassment. So we're seeing a confluence of popular political mobilization, and that could shift the needle, I think. there's no question that that there's potential for the first time to change things. So let's hope that this energy can get channeled into a long-lasting new movement, one that in which our kids lead the way.
Well, of course, the president is not going to lead the way. That's for sure. Everything is about him. And he tweeted out, very sad that the FBI missed all of the many signals sent by the Florida school shooter. This is not acceptable. They are spending too much time trying to prove Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. So that seems to be where his head's at.
Right. Well, I mean, it's sort of a typical narcissistic comment from President Trump. I mean, there's almost no connection between the parts of the FBI that are dealing with Russian tampering in our elections and the part of the FBI that would have dealt with this. And then the mistakes that were made in the FBI are, of course, tragic, and we'll need to get to the bottom of them. But, I mean, the fundamental reality of this is that someone who was dangerous enough to be expelled was not prohibited from owning a firearm. And you know, people like Marco Rubio, who I hope gets voted out of office because his response was really unacceptable, who say there's nothing that would have changed this. It's simply not true. I mean, we have developed some new approaches to gun violence that are slowly starting to be implemented, and one of them is this extreme violence restraining order, where when people are potentially dangerous, we can go in and remove the firearms. And it seems to me that anyone who's attending a public school who's been expelled, the first thing that should happen is they should make sure that there are no firearms in that person's life. And the fact that these parents thought it was okay to allow him to have his gun as long as he locked it up, we just have to change that attitude. That's just not acceptable. That's not responsible.
So do you think Donald Trump should own the fact that this shooter, this troubled 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz, there's a video and photographs of him doing target practice wearing a Make America Great Again hat?
Well, I mean, there's no question that Trump has allied himself with the NRA, which is, of course, become a radical gun rights organization. It's not the NRA of 40 years ago. It's not the NRA of 50 years ago in organizations like the NRA. And unfortunately, the Republican Party, once upon a time, there were sensible Republicans who believed in reasonable kinds of regulation. But that part of the Republican Party has been silenced and exiled. So, we need to have a lot more discussion about what should be done. And we need, for one thing, to allow people who research these things to actually get access to the data. I mean, it's just crazy. You still can't do research on gun violence because, Congress will not fund the CDC to do it.
And again, I'm speaking with Saul Cornell, who's the chair of American History at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court. And his forthcoming book is The Partisan Republic, Democracy, Exclusion, and the Demise of the Founders' Constitution. Well, the other politician, of course, that these young students went after, along with Donald Trump, is Governor Rick Scott, who's also, along with Marco Rubio, has taken a lot of money from the NRA. And when you mentioned the shooter and his troubled past, apparently there were 39 calls for the police to come to the house, 20 recently. He was adopted along with his brother. The adopted father died a while back. The mother died, I think, in November. He was very obviously bereft over the loss of his mother, even though she had called the cops on him many times. Social workers had come to the house, and the cry for help was clearly repetitive, but social workers didn't follow up. I think he was put on medication, but whether he kept taking these drugs or not, we don't know. Governor Rick Scott is responsible for a law in Florida that forbids police and social workers for asking the parents or the troubled kid whether there is a gun, there are guns in the house.
That clearly has to change. I mean, we have created this fantasy version of the Second Amendment that's almost the exact opposite of the original Second Amendment. I mean, this idea that there's some right of privacy that attaches to gun ownership is just intellectually and historically ludicrous. I mean, if the colonists had asserted some kind of right of privacy against their state governments, we wouldn't have had a militia. I mean, the very idea of a well-regulated militia is premised upon the idea that the government, in this case, it would have been the state governments or the colonial governments and then the state governments, they had to know who had guns. They had to know what condition they were in. They actually inspected them. They fined people for not properly taking care of their guns. So this idea that somehow, you know, we can't do a better job of finding out who has firearms and who shouldn't have firearms just is antithetical to the Second Amendment. I mean, the idea that the ATF is forbidden from implementing modern technologies like electronic databases. I mean, how on earth do you get out of the Second Amendment? No, you know, Congress shall not allow government organizations to use electronic databases. I mean, it's just absurd.
Well, but the whole Second Amendment was turned on its head in the Heller decision that was put forth by Justice Scalia. And the predicate is a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state was turned on its head. And the second part, which is a citizen's right to bear arms, shall not be infringed or abridged. I'm not sure what the last word is, but
Infringed,
right. So there you have it. I mean, the cart is now before the horse. Does anybody talk about a well-regulated militia? I know some of these kids down in Florida were talking about it. You know, whatever happened to that concept of well-regulated?
Well, exactly. I mean, one of the things that we forget is that guns have been regulated for as long as there have been guns in America, and there were gun regulations at the time of the Second Amendment. The level of regulation in America actually got more robust after the Second Amendment, not less robust. So any idea that somehow the Second Amendment is antithetical to regulation is this fantasy we've created that undermines the actual Second Amendment. I mean, that's what's so frustrating is all these people who invoke the Second Amendment spouting it almost like they have some kind of Second Amendment Tourette syndrome where they just sort of spout it without being able to control their speech, simply don't understand much about American history or much about the Second Amendment. So, you know, rather than call for repealing the Second Amendment, which we sometimes hear, I think we need to actually honor and understand the real Second Amendment, not this libertarian fantasy that we've conjured up that has very little to do with the real Second Amendment.
So do you think that there will be a time in this country, and hopefully led by these young students from the Florida High School, that the public will sort of recognize that the rights of a handful of gun owners, there's only 5 million members of the NRA, that the rights of the handful of gun owners to have unlimited access to firearms and collect unlimited amounts of firearms trumps the rights of all American citizens to be safe in the streets, in their homes, in their schools, and in their churches, and in the malls of America? That seems to be where we're at now. When the Second Amendment says well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state, we are neither secure or we are all free. Guns are not making us secure, not making us free. They're doing the opposite. And the reason that we're in this situation is that 5 million people are given unlimited rights at the expense of the rest of us.
Well, Ian, I think you've hit on something. I mean, we again, these sort of pseudo Second Amendment champions who really don't understand the Second Amendment, they only quote part of the amendment, and I think you've correctly emphasized that the whole Second Amendment was aimed at promoting the security of a free state, and the Founding Fathers were not anarchists. I mean, they the concept that they venerated was something they called well-regulated liberty, and was distinguished between a kind of libertarian licentiousness on the one hand and a tyrannical authoritarianness on the other. So, you know, we have sort of gone over to a notion of liberty that is antithetical to the founders' idea of liberty. Their notion of liberty was very, very different. They were not against the idea of regulation. They were not anarchists. They were not anti-statist. I mean, they had a healthy suspicion of government, as we all should, but, you know, their goal was not to reduce us to a Hobbesian state of nature. I mean, that was what was to be avoided at all costs. So I quite agree. I mean, what we've created is a situation where we are sacrificing the liberty of the majority of Americans for a misguided understanding of liberty for a minority of Americans. And there's simply no reason why we can't create a better system of regulation that will honor the very real history of guns in America, in which, you know, I mean, America will probably never be Australia, England, or even Canada, and it's not realistic to expect it to be. But at the same token, there's just no way you can say that the system we have now is in any way consistent with the ideals of what the founders put in place, nor is it consistent with the sort of deeply rooted traditions in our country. You know, it's based on the Hollywood version of our history, in the Hollywood version of the Wild West, but the real Wild West, you checked your guns at the edge of town. So we need a sort of historical antidote to the mythology and ideology that is distorting our understanding of our own history.
Well, of course, you being a historian of the Second Amendment and having written a well-regulated militia, the Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, whose right to bear arms did the Second Amendment protect? My understanding is when Tom Paine was talking about Sunshine Patriots, what happened was the French supplied a lot of the arms to the American revolutionaries, but they would hand them out to these farmers and volunteers. And so they'd take the guns and not necessarily show up when they were mustered. And what happened initially was that the guns were the first guns to be regulated in America, because George Washington had an inventory and he wanted to make sure that these guys showed up with their guns when they were called to battle.
Well, I think we've got some great new scholarship on the role of guns in early American history that took a long time to do correctly. We had a lot of bad scholarship on it for a while, but now we actually have some good scholarship. And the big takeaway, there really are two big takeaways from that new scholarship. One is that the great danger Americans feared was not that government would take people's guns away, is that government would not do enough to make sure people had the guns they needed to participate in the militia. So, you know, our whole view of the Second Amendment is shaped by these libertarian fantasies, you know, the Red Dawn fantasy, the Dirty Harry fantasy, that dominate our modern culture. But the founders lived in a different world. They lived in a world where they feared standing armies. Of course, today we have a very large standing army. And so their fear was not that you'd have governments confiscating weapons. Their fear was that government wouldn't do enough to facilitate Americans to purchase their own guns that they needed to participate in the militia. I mean, that is such a different world than the one that we live in, and you can't really understand the Second Amendment unless you understand that that was the world they lived in and that was the reality on the ground. If you try and, you know, understand the Second Amendment with this sort of Red Dawn fantasy in mind, it's no wonder you come up with Wayne LaPierre's crazy notions.
Well, Saul Cannella, I thank you for joining us. We'll stay in touch. Hopefully next time we'll have something more up optimistic to talk about.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Saul Cannella, who's the chair in American history at Fordham University and the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, Whose Right to Bear Arms Did the Second Amendment Protect? And his latest book is The Second Amendment Goes to Court, and his forthcoming book is The Partisan Republic, Democracy, Exclusion, and the Demise of the Founders' Constitution. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back speaking with a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School, who's a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, about his new book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ganesh Sitaraman, who is a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's been a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, serving as her speechwriter, policy director, and senior counsel. And his latest book just out is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ganesh Sitaraman.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Ganesh, the Constitution itself, which you feel is endangered by growing income inequality, and we're heading away from democracy towards plutocracy, and I think that's an inescapably clear fact. Give us your fundamental arguments about why it is that the U.S. Constitution was unique in as much as it sort of basically encouraged, enabled a kind of middle-class country. And of course, the American Revolution was fought against an aristocratic system with the King of England at the head of which. And of course, we had Tories in this country who, after the revolution, fled into Canada and elsewhere. So we know that most of the European democracies evolved out of an aristocratic system, but you make the case that the United States is different in terms of democracies.
That's exactly right. The United States was very different. And I think it's surprising for most people today to think about economic inequality as something that has anything to do with our Constitution, because the Constitution doesn't mention economic equality or inequality or the middle class. But what's striking is that people throughout history, from the ancient Greeks onward, were very, very concerned about the problem of economic inequality. And they worried that in a society that was deeply unequal economically, the rich would oppress the poor, and the poor would try to confiscate the wealth of the rich. And the result would be violence, strife, and revolution. And so the answer to this problem that people came up with, and this is starting way back in the days of Rome, was what I call a class warfare constitution. And the idea is that you build economic class right into the constitutional structure. So in ancient Rome, there's a patrician senate for the wealthiest elites, but there's also a tribune of the plebs for the plebeians, for ordinary and more poor people. In England, which you just mentioned, there's the House of Lords for the wealthy elites, and there's the House of Commons for commoners, for everybody else. And the idea is that each class has a share in governing, but each class also has a check on the other, which is what prevents instability and revolution. Now, what is so striking about the U.S. Constitution is it's not like these kind of class warfare constitutions. We don't have a tribune of the plebs. We don't have wealth minimums for being a senator. We don't have wealth maximums on being a member of the House of Representatives. Our Constitution is radically different from what came before. And that's the argument of the book. What we have is a constitution that assumes a large middle class, that assumes that we have relative economic equality, and that's why it doesn't have any of these class-based checks that were the fundamental structural feature of most Republican governments prior to the U.S. Constitution.
So on the other side of the coin, this phenomenon of income inequality and the growing income gap and the fact that Oxfam did a recent report that finds that something like 85 families control half of the globe's wealth. And it does seem that we're heading back into a kind of medieval model where you have a small global elite and a vast sort of roiling peasantry and then a small professional class of lawyers and accountants who are essentially dedicated to wealth management. Why is this apparently an inexorable trend? Why is it that more and more wealth is being concentrated into fewer and fewer hands? And it's a global phenomenon, not just here in the United States.
Well, one of the challenges, and this is what people have been worried about throughout history, is that when you start having economic inequality, the wealthiest people, the wealthiest corporations, the wealthiest interest groups, use their wealth to try to influence government. And they influence policymaking, they influence campaigns, they sometimes work themselves in government, but what they try to do is skew policies to benefit themselves. And what that means is that policies start benefiting them and they grow even wealthier. And now they have even more wealth to use to spend on government influence. And so what you get is what one commentator has called the doom loop of oligarchy, which is sort of a vicious cycle where the wealthiest just keep getting wealthier because they can use their economic power to lobby and control government, and then to increase their further economic power. And this is the deep challenge of trying to get out of this kind of system.
And again, I'm speaking with Ganesh Sitaraman, who is a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's been a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, serving as her speechwriter, policy director, and senior counsel. And his latest book just out is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. So we had a different revolution, a revolution against an aristocratic system. And even though, of course, initially the Founding Fathers didn't really want to share the franchise with too many people, white men of property, and gradually over the centuries, more and more Americans have been enfranchised. But there's still that kind of trend, if you will, in the political DNA of this country to make voting difficult. We're the only country in the world that has this complicated process of registration, and different states and counties, all of whom have different election laws. So there are vestiges still. And of course, you could make the case that the South has a plantation economy. Of course, the British did support the South in the Civil War, sort of trying to restore a kind of Tory system down there, which I think vestiges of which still exist to this day. So I wouldn't suggest that we're totally egalitarian, but we certainly are in our ethos, aren't we? Our mythology is egalitarian. I mean, Donald Trump ran as an egalitarian, as a populist, even though he's a billionaire.
Well, this is one of the things that I think is really important about our country and who we are, is that, you know, even though at the beginning our system wasn't entirely equal, you know, as you rightly pointed out and as I point out in the book, when the founding generation talked about relative economic equality, they meant within their political community of white men. The idea of a middle class in the political community being essential to our system really leaves open the question of who do we consider part of our political community. And there has been a strong and important tradition throughout our history of inclusiveness and of fighting to expand the political community to include minorities, to include women. And it's been a struggle and one that's been violently contested throughout our history. But what I think is so striking is that the people who have been at the forefront of those struggles for inclusion have understood that it wasn't enough to just have political freedom. It was also essential to have economic justice. And so if you look back at Reconstruction after the Civil War, the Reconstruction Republicans believed not just in voting rights and in the franchise for the freed slaves of the South, they believe in economic justice. And so Thaddeus Stevens, one of the leaders of that group, argues for confiscating the lands of the top 10% of Confederate planters and redistributing those lands to their former slaves. And his idea behind this is that he wants to end having a landed aristocracy in the South and having a landless class in the South, and that you had to have, 40 acres and a mule, that's where that phrase comes from, is that period, in order to have economic justice, and that was actually just as critical to a democracy as having the right to vote and having political rights and civil rights.
Well, it wasn't so long ago that one of the wealthiest men in America, Warren Buffett, warned that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy, and there's no question that Donald Trump is attacking democratic institutions. And I think your book points out that we are at a kind of crossroads here in terms of the income inequality being the real issue in terms of whether or not we remain a democracy or become a plutocracy. Where would you say we are in terms of, are we on the cusp of losing our democracy?
I think we are in a place that is pretty dangerous. I call my book The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution because I think we're in an era of crisis. And I'll say it's not just about or even necessarily about Donald Trump. I think we were in this crisis prior to the election of 2016. One of the things that people throughout history have been worried about is that when you transition from a republic which is just a representative democracy, into a oligarchy or a plutocracy or an aristocracy. It doesn't happen because you have a constitutional convention and everybody votes by referendum to say, let's be an oligarchy. It happens slowly. It happens through the creation of laws. It happens through policies. It happens without people really knowing. And then one day you look around and you don't really have the kind of representative democracy you thought you did. And so, you know, I think we've been in a place of serious danger along these lines for some time now. And, you know, my worry is that unless we really do something serious to change that, it may be too late.
Well, I think the biggest change, surely, was Citizens United, where, you know, now we have a completely money-driven system. It didn't happen overnight. Obviously, we've been heading in that direction where our representatives are essentially telemarketers. They spend most of their days dialing for dollars. And we do have a system now where politics is not about issues, policies, and candidates, but just about money and dark money at that, because of these 501c4 so-called social welfare vehicles that are being used by plutocrats like the Koch brothers and others, the Mercers, etc. That's how Trump got elected, 861 million, most of which poured in at the last minute through these dark money vehicles. So let's talk a little bit about, I think we've covered how bad things are and how they're getting worse in terms of jeopardy to the fundamental democratic nature of the United States. But let's talk a little bit about how it can be reversed. Now, it would seem to me that you have to change Citizens United. If you can't change the Supreme Court, you've got to put laws in, like the Disclose Act, for example, that came in after Citizens United, which the Republicans blocked.
So I agree. I think it's important that we work on campaign finance issues. I think that's a critical part of the story. But I'd actually step back a little bit and look at the wide variety of things that we need to do. And the place I think where we should take inspiration is from the progressive era. Just over 100 years ago, the United States was in a period of time that we now consider the Gilded Age. That was an era of increasing inequality, increasing corporate power, increasing corruption in government. And what people in the populist era of the late 19th century and the progressive era of the early 20th century did was try to attack both the economic side of this problem and the political side of the problem. So on the economic side, those generations created antitrust laws to try to break up big concentrations of economic power. They passed a constitutional amendment to have an income tax so that the wealthiest people would pay more. They worked for minimum wages and maximum hours legislation and for equal pay for women. And they did all of these things on the economic side because they understood, as Teddy Roosevelt said, that you cannot have a political democracy without an economic democracy. But on the flip side, they also wanted to make sure that the people who were more economically powerful couldn't use their wealth and power to influence government. And so it was during this time period that we had the first real federal campaign finance regulations. And it's also during this time period that we shifted from state legislators choosing senators to having the direct election of senators by the people. And the reason for that was there were a number of reasons, but one of the main reasons was that there was a lot of fear about bribery happening in the state legislatures over senators. And so, you know, I think those are two ways we can think about what we need to do today. It's making our economy more democratic, and it's also making our politics more responsive and democratic.
But Ganesh, we're at a time now where people are scratching their heads about how many massacres take place in the United States, gun violence, the latest one being the 18th school massacre just this year, and the year has barely begun. And when you watch all of the debates going on, you realize the massive denial going on with our politicians who talk about prayer and our hearts go out to the victims and we pray for them, etc. But no talk about any concrete, practical and real solutions to both the mental health and the intersection between mental health and access to firearms because of the NRA. And there you have it. I mean, that's, again, about money and political intimidation on the foreign policy field. It's very difficult to have an even-handed policy between the Israelis and the Palestinians because of the power of AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee. And I could go on and list all of the powerful lobbying groups in this country. So how do you deal with lobbying? Obviously, it's something that you can't outlaw, but how can you regulate it to the point where you don't have the tyranny of the minority, where, you know, there's only not even 5 million members of the NRA, but they totally dominate the agenda?
Well, I think there's a couple of things we need to think about. One is, what can we do to regulate things like lobbying and influence in government? And then the second thing, though, is how do we actually get that stuff done? And on the first question, I think there's a lot of different ways to think about it. So, you know, one of the real challenges that we have in Washington is that we have people leaving Congress all the time to go off and be lobbyists. That is something that, you know, one can restrict. We also don't have a deep development of career people working in Congress, developing expertise, becoming real pros on issues. And as a result, if you don't have really expert people working on these issues, you have to rely more on lobbyists because the lobbyists know things and can tell members of Congress about how something works. And so, you know, there are ways that we can think about getting more people with experience and expertise working in government. There's ways we can try to restrict the revolving door of people just leaving and treading on their old connections in order to be lobbyists. So I think there are some solutions we can think about in those areas. The real challenge is, how do we get this stuff done? And how do we get it done in a context where, you know, the game already works really well for the lobbyists, and they'll lobby pretty heavily against especially changing lobbying rules? And I think the answer to that is, it requires a lot of popular pressure and mobilization. And one of the things that at least I'm somewhat heartened by is, on both the left and the right, there's a lot of anger about this. You know, whether it's supporters of Bernie Sanders who are worried that the system is rigged, or supporters of Donald Trump who wanted to drain the swamp, there is a general sense in America that we have a serious problem in government, and that government is no longer responsive to what we all need and want as part of the common good. And I think that's a starting point for us to try to build a kind of national movement to try to make changes along these lines.
Well, Ganesh Shataraman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ganesh Shataraman, who's a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's been a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, serving as her speechwriter, policy director, and senior counsel. And his latest book just out is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.